Persons Committee to Order. Today is March 31st, 2017. The time is 3:32 p.m. Committee members present today, Senator Meyer, Senator Stedman, Senator Von Imhoff, and Senator Hughes, as well as myself, Senator Giesel. So today, thank you, first of all, to Ann and Tom, who are helping us out with the audio. Today, we're going to be hearing an update on the Interior Energy Project. This was a project that was approved a couple years ago, and we're going to just be getting an update today. After that, we will be hearing Senate Bill 92 for the second time by Senator Matschke. So we'll begin with the Interior Energy Project update. So I'll invite Jean Theriault and Jomo Stewart to the table. Welcome. I'll let you go ahead and introduce yourselves for the record and proceed with your presentations.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Jean Theriault with ADA, and I am, on behalf of ADA, the IEP project lead on the ADA side.
And I am Jomo Stewart. I'm the General Manager of the Interior Gas Utility, which is the municipal utility.
Great.
And then Mr. Britton is online. I'm not sure if he's on hot
he
audio.
He's not online yet.
But Mr. Britton is the CEO of Pentex, which was the formerly private utility, currently under ADA ownership.
Okay, great. Well, if he pops up, I'll let you know.
Okay.
Great.
There he is.
Oh, there he is. Well, Dan Britton, yeah, is online. Okay. All right. So I'll let you go, gentlemen, go ahead and begin.
All right. Good afternoon. Again, my name is Jomo Stewart. I'm the General Manager of the Interior Gas Utility. We'll just jump right into it. I understand that you have a bill that will follow, and so I'd like to leave you ample time to have that consideration. All right, so just as a brief summary of the presentation, we'll start with a bit of a project synopsis. We'll move through the project history. I understand we do have some members who weren't present when the project actually originally began, and so we just wanted to walk through that really briefly. A bit of a project status update, and then a little bit of a look forward. So regarding the project synopsis, just as a reminder, the purpose and goals of the Interior Energy Project is originally defined, and it's still current. It's actually the mission and the goals of our organization, the Interior Gas Utility, is to bring low-cost energy to as many residents and businesses of the interior as possible, as quickly as possible, formulated when the price of energy, which is oil, which was the predominant fuel and still is the predominant fuel in Fairbanks, had reached really catastrophic levels as far as our economy was concerned. It was in the $4 plus range, which was quite an increase over the historic norm, which for decades had been in the $1.50 a gallon range. So it was quite a predicament we were in. And so the goal was really to reduce the cost of energy, stabilize it so it could help stabilize our economy, but also help us with an air quality challenge that had kind of sprung up over the course of that run-up in the cost of oil. People made an economic decision to switch to something that was cheaper, that was wood, but ironically enough, that renewable local resource also had a negative impact on air quality as, you know, a dent of our geography and weather. And so it was hoped that by bringing natural gas at a good price, we can encourage people not only to switch from oil, but also to possibly let wood go back to being a kind of a lifestyle choice as opposed to an economic necessity. Now, there were a bit of that was from the local level. We did have some statewide goals, at least the project proponents, with the Interior Energy Project. And that was the fact that when we were considering, the project sponsors were considering the project, we recognized at the time that we were approaching that place where the state would no longer be in a position or might no longer be in a position to offer large-scale grants to help with necessary infrastructure and development within the state. And so what were we going to do? It wasn't like those needs were going to go away, simply that the state's capacity to just straight fund things through grants was going to be more and more limited. And so what we came up with, the project sponsors, was a system of finance that was modeled after actually the Bradley Lake model, where a blend of grants and debt finance, but under a revolving loan system, thereby allowing the state to hopefully still be able to continue to provide development financing to projects, but also have that financing be available to future projects for other communities that were similarly situated to Fairbanks, Alaska, of which there are hundreds, literally hundreds. I'd say about half the state's population really is in the same kind of boat when it comes to oil that Fairbanks is. And it was something that I actually hadn't realized until I'd spoken here in this body to some of you legislators from around the state. So just as a quick graphic of the Interior Energy Project, the project definition, transition the energy economy from oil and wood to a cleaner, less expensive fuel, natural gas, by increasing the LNG production capacity, of which the community already has some down in Big Lake, but expand that so there could be more LNG available, more to increase the transportation's deliverability to town, increase the storage capacity, which would improve the deliverability of that gas around the community, build out that distribution system, and also help folks as much as we can with the conversion process. So a bit about the project history. The original funding for what became the Interior Energy Project actually came down from this body in 2011. It was a $500,000 grant to do a gas distribution, essentially a gas distribution study for the community. At the time, you all will recall there were a lot of discussions about different transportation methods of North Slope gas. Big lines, bullet lines, there were proposals bringing gas up from Cook Inlet, but what was recognized is that though all roads led to and through Fairbanks for natural gas, we actually had a very limited capacity to move it around, so that if the gas had just shown up in 2011, it would actually just go right past town. There'd only be about 1,000 customers who could utilize it, and so it would probably behoove us to do some research and figure out how we would actually bring that gas to people. And so that $500,000 came down. It became the FNSB gas distribution system analysis. It was completed by the FNSB, actually through Fairbanks Economic Development. I was project manager for that. Coming out of that process, so we had a really nice study that showed, gave you kind of a high-level look at what a gas distribution system for all of Fairbanks would look like. We had some basic costing for that. That's great. Well, how do we operationalize that? How do we keep that from just being a dusty study on the shelf? And one of the ways we came up with, the community came up with, was to actually establish a municipal utility to take care of those areas that were not covered by the private utilities certificate to serve. FNG at the time had a has a certificated area that only really encompasses core Fairbanks. This municipality, the one of which I'm now general manager, RCPCN runs from North Pole to the east up around the ridges, making gas available to the remainder of those high and medium density areas within the community. In 2013, had some conversations with the governor's office to see if there might be some ways to effectuate that financing package that we had discussed. The governor bit, Governor Parnell bit, and the legislature did also. And in fact, did provide some funding to help kickstart this project. The term Interior Energy Project was actually coined by the Governor Parnell, and it was the name for the funding package, essentially, in the process. And so what came down was a blended finance package, relatively light on loan, or excuse me, on grant, with some really nice loan components. And so that was about $57.5 million worth of grant, $125 million worth of SETS loans under favorable terms, or the allowance to offer favorable terms, and then $150 million worth of bonding authority. And so let's see. Later on in that year also, the Interior Gas Utility did go out, went to the RCA, and did acquire a CPCN for that service area, encompassing those little slightly more far-flung areas of the Fairbanks community. Yes, ma'am.
Senator Hughes.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question. You used the word kickstart for the funding and then the $362.5 million financing package. Is that a kickstart? Is there additional funding, or is that $362.5 million the estimated amount for the entire project from start to finish? And then of that, how much of it is, or maybe you're going to go through this later, how much of that is for the conversion piece?
Respectfully through the chair, yes, I used the term kickstart, and that's actually the term that Governor Parnell used also. When they did the original gas distribution study, the total project cost to fully plumb the community from main lines down to service lines was actually more in the $600 million range. And so the funding was, it was never expected that that funding package, this funding package would be sufficient to do the whole project in total.
Thank you.
Okay. Now, regarding conversions, and it is actually, we'll see it in a, another slide a little later on when we describe the package. Yes, it is countenance. There's $3 million of programmatic funds built into the financing package to help with conversion assistance. Now, how exactly that's going to operate is still under discussion. For my own entity, one of our most recent projects is one of my engineers working on mapping out an on-bill repayment program, not unlike the program you've heard about for PACE, the PACE legislation for that goes through the borough, that attaches to a property tax bill. This would be a citizen going to a bank, getting a loan, but they would be able to pay that loan back in increments on their bill, on their gas bill.
And Madam Chairman, just as far as the whether
you
the
could put yourself on the record, Mr. Terrio.
Gene Terrio with ADA. As far as the whether the package was the complete funding that would be needed, I was working for Governor Parnell at the time, and the thought was, you know, how much support is needed and what type of support to get the enterprise up and physically on its feet, financially on its feet, so that it would be able to then just perform the function of a utility going forward, accessing capital markets to build out the complete system over time.
Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am. Okay, so in 2014, F&G began its own system expansion, again, to put those pipes in the ground beyond just serving those 1,000 customers out of a total of potential of 22,000 structures within the community plus. And so they did. They began what was a two-year build in 2014 and 15 infill. Let's see, pursuit of a north slope configuration. If you'll recall, the original configuration for the project was going to be off of the north slope. We can talk about that some more if you'd like, but you know, we can go on. Okay. So in 2015, F&G completed its second year for its build-out. It still has a few areas left to go, but for the most part, it has, in fact, plumbed the community of Fairbanks proper. Also in that time frame, the IGU, we did our first initial build, our Phase 1 build, which covered the southern half of Core North Pole. So we put in 70 miles of pipe in a summer, and that was taken care of. The legislature, for its part, took action and allowed for a broader pursuit of the project. Essentially, it allowed us to look further afield than just the North Slope. The original legislation for this project actually had mandated that the LNG facility be on the North Slope, so the legislation was amended to allow us to look further afield, and i.e. Cook Inlet. Okay, and we began pursuing that option.
And then on the last bullet there, having
if
come
you'd introduce yourself again. I know with two male voices, folks listening need to know who's speaking. Sorry.
Gene Terrio. At that time, having come through looking at the enterprise sourcing gas off the North Slope and the economics of that, it was determined that if we had the two utilities, one a private sector utility and IGU, the outlying areas in Fairbanks, in order to get a reasonably priced commodity to the communities, we needed to aggregate that demand. It is the second largest metropolitan area in the state, you know, if you think of the Cook Inlet community sort of as one big metropolitan area, but the overall demand is relatively small for the cost of the infrastructure. And so at that time, that's when ADA stepped forward and actually purchased the Pentex assets so that we could align the business structures of the two utilities and prepare them to be integrated together.
Joma Stewart. Thank you, ma'am. All right, and in pursuit of the Cook Inlet configuration, ADA went through a robust RFP process. Actually, first they went through a robust reassessment process. We threw the doors wide open as far as energy, and we assessed a whole range. We let everybody in the world come in and offer what they thought should be an energy or could be an energy solution for Fairbanks, and we went ahead and assessed all of those. It did come back to gas, and it did go back to Cook Inlet in the end. And through an RFP process, ADA selected Salix to be the development partner for the Cook Inlet configuration. However, throughout the during the course of 2016, when you began to really crunch the numbers, when we crunched the numbers, we realized that there was the project just couldn't support much extra cost. If we were going to hit the goals of the project, which was to deliver $15 per MCF gas to consumers, there just was not a lot of financial wiggle room. An example would be with a private sector LNG facility owner, you would be subject to taxation, whereas under a nonprofit model or municipal model, that would be a fee that would no longer need to accrue to the project. And so it was discussed with Salix, and there was an amicable dissolution of the partnership. And I do mean amicable. For a relatively low cost for their front-end work, the project was allowed to retain what had been the pre-FEED work that Salix had done, and also access to the contractors who had performed it, and thereby there wouldn't be any appreciable timeline impact to the unwind. We would be able to stay on timeline. Also throughout 2016, and really this took up the bulk of the activities of 2016, were negotiations between IGU and Pentex, IGU and ADA, regarding that unification that Mr. Terrio just spoke of. The purchase of Pentex and the financing of the IEP using those funds that had been provided by the legislature, culminating at the end of the year and into the top of 2017 this year with the drafting and the signing of an MOU, a Memorandum of Understanding, to command the more detailed work of the transaction documents. Okay. So the status of the project, and we'll just jump right on into the MOU, because the MOU actually tells a lot about what the project plans and development plans are and how it will be funded. And by the way, that's a public document, and my understanding is that within a fortnight, ADA will be providing their quarterly update to the legislature, and so it'll either have a link to that MOU or to the MOU itself. Okay. So just a quick rundown of some definitions, because we're going to use some terms throughout the rest of this presentation, and it can get a little confusing. Certainly, it can be for some. Let's see. When we refer to Titan, what we're really talking about is the LNG facility that is currently in Big Lake that's owned by Pentex, but also the expansion of that facility. So Titan 1 is the existing facility as it stands now. As part of this process, it'll be upgraded to a slightly larger capacity, giving it about a 1.5 BCF worth of capacity. That's a billion cubic feet a year of LNG production capacity. Titan 2 and Titan 3 are 3 BCF tranches of additional capacity. Okay, when we talk about the distribution phases for the IGU, we have what we divide as a six-phase build-out process, again, to plumb those areas within our CPCN. Phase one, again, having been performed back in 2015, the southern half of North Pole, Alaska. And then for FNG, it's their infill and their a little bit of extra expansion. When we talk about storage, what we're talking about is a couple of large storage facilities, one very large storage facility and another satellite storage facility out in North Pole, because right now the systems are disconnected. But that large storage facility is 5.2 million gallons of LNG storage in Fairbanks. Okay.
So, Mr. Stewart, before you go on, so what population are you going to need utilizing this gas in Fairbanks? What's your threshold for actually making this economic?
You know, I actually did I did have a few of those performed. I can just tell you that per this discussion, that it's built on essentially 9,000 customers.
And how many does Fairbanks have right now?
1,000.
Okay.
But we'll get to that. It's actually there's a number slide.
Okay. Okay.
And Madam Chairman, Gene Terrio, as we've gone forward, initially in 2015, there was thought that the price of oil had come down. Mm-hmm. Some people thought, well, it was a temporary lowering and it would go back up moderately. That hasn't. It looks like we are living in a lower, competing fuel world, and will be for a time being. So we had actually had some customer we'd done surveys and focus groups with customers to see at what price would they be incented to actually, transfer over to natural gas. And so a lot of the numbers that we're now using is built on this lower fuel oil world that we're living in, where we think that the actual customer conversion to natural gas will take a little bit longer. And so we're not counting on this huge, rapid customer customers hooking up and building that into the economics to make sure that we've got a utility that can certainly pay its bills, is financially sound enough to go to the financial markets in the future.
What does it cost for a resident to convert their house?
It really depends on the age of their existing boiler and what equipment they have right now. If you've got a boiler that is less than 10 years old, depending on the manufacturer, you actually might be able to convert it over by just changing out the gun. You'd want to be able to do that and have it be Underwriter Laboratories certified so that, you know, if there's a fire, you know, that you haven't negated your fire insurance by doing something that was unsafe. If you've got a boiler that is beyond that, it can be quite expensive. It can be $10,000 to $12,000. My wife and I bought a house in Fairbanks, built in 1985. Would have loved to have linked that existing boiler on until natural gas was actually available, but we just couldn't get there. So we had to swap ours out, and did so by putting in a fuel oil burner that can more economically be changed when gas is available. And to do that, it cost me $12,000. So it's not insignificant. If you have to swap out the entire system.
Sure. Okay. Good. Any other questions? Senator Stedman.
Yes, Madam Chairman. Just, I know we're kind of beating around the bush on it, and I didn't see anything forward in your presentation, but at some point it'd be nice to talk about the delivery cost of the burner tip, what you expect, what the competitive environment is with oil, if you have an 80% boiler, 90% boiler efficiency, what have you. And then benchmark that, I guess, against Anchorage, because as I recall, it was somewhere around $4 barrel oil, $3.50 oil was the target a couple of years ago with Fairbanks, and you guys were at about 23 cents a kilowatt for electric, and you were looking at somewhere around double the cost of natural gas relative to the Anchorage bowl. But as I recall, I think it was down in that $3.50, $4 range of oil, but maybe we can get refreshed on some of those numbers.
Sure. Madam Chairman, to the Senator's questions, Gene Terrio. When oil was $4, that's equivalent to natural gas price is equivalent to about $30. $4 oil compared to natural gas, that would be a $30 natural gas, basically. And so the target for the project was to try and deliver the natural gas to a residential consumer at about $15. That would be equivalent to $2 fuel oil. So that's our target, and compared to, you know, I'm not sure what the delivered price is in Anchorage right now.
11.
You know, it would still be substantially more than Anchorage, but that was the target price.
And if I could, Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Stedman.
What's the, you know, we have ballpark of the current environment for fuel oil delivery in Fairbanks, and, you know, where this project stacks up relative to that $2 oil target?
I know that Fairbanks Natural Gas regularly polls fuel distributors. The last time that I was in the office there and heard the number of deliveries to a residential house was about $2.40. So still a little bit of a delta between what we hope to deliver for, but definitely is suppressed.
Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you. I did sort of jump ahead a little bit on some of the slides here, and I do appreciate the definitions and the description of the project. But I think what's really important here is to jump on what Senator Giesel stated. It's about between 8,500 and 9,000 customers to make this viable. But we're looking here, it's about a $333 million project all set in. And it says of that, about $4.75 million only is commercial financing, and appears to be the rest is estate financing. Now, granted, I understand that some of this was passed, well, all of this was passed several years ago, 13, 14, and 15, to set aside this money. It just seems that there really isn't a viable private partner in this. It's completely state-funded to provide energy to 8 to 9,000 people. And it's a lot of money. Can the state afford to do this right now? How come there isn't any commercial partner? Are they not seeing the viability of this? When I see loan terms that are 50-year payoff at 0.25% with deferment of any interest payment for 15 years, that's a little worrisome, and that's definitely out of the norm of normal financing terms, and also leads me to believe that, you know, it's providing a lot of cushion to make this thing work. But does this thing work? Are we ever going to get paid back?
Madam Chairman, to the Senator's question, this is Gene Terrio. That's one of the things that the ADA board, before they actually pull the trigger on the consolidation and utilization of the tools, back in 2015, when the legislation and the financing package was refreshed, there's a requirement that the ADA board, you know, look at, you know, is there a supply of gas that is going to make the project feasible? What are the estimation of the conversions and the uptake? Basically, do we see an economic enterprise coming forward that will, in fact, make the project be successful? That's a requirement of the ADA board. And so as we paper the MOU, put together all of the agreements to make that happen, that is one of the charges that was specifically given to the ADA board. And of the total 300-plus financing package, there are the loans out of the SETS fund, very attractive terms granted, and the access to the bond markets. And those bonds then have to be paid back by the project.
Follow-up, Senator Von Imhoff?
So you say an enterprise coming forward to make it viable. What does that mean?
Combined utility to aggregate the total demand, to blend the industrial and light industrial use in the core of Fairbanks with the outlying residential area, to assure that a postage stamp rate is achievable to the customers, both business and residential, that would actually incentivize people to utilize the product. Mind you, there, while the enterprise initially was started, due to the cost of energy, there is also the air quality issue in Fairbanks that is becoming as much of a driver also.
Okay. Follow-up, Senator Von Imhoff.
Just last comment here. I just feel that when we, in general, when ADA looks at projects, is there a particular hurdle rate, as in if the hurdle is too great, the return is too small, the costs are too great, there's a go versus no go? And I don't know, like, if you had two or three different projects and you're comparing the three, this Fairbanks natural gas system is one of however other projects that you have. How does this one compare to other $300 million projects that you have versus go, no go decisions? It just, the sense of it, not seeing this really before, it just seems extremely high hurdle, and that's almost like cost is no factor. We're just going to make this happen for Fairbanks because of all the good things that it does, and it doesn't matter that it costs $334 million.
And Madam Chairman, the discussion at the time and this particular set of financing tools was set for this project with specific instructions that interest was to be capped at 3%. The cost of the bonds were to be utilized the strength of the state to access the bond market and make them available, try and pass that benefit on to the project. So this particular set of financing tools was set up specifically for this project. So they're not compared to other projects.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So first of all, this project requires a adequate supply of gas, and there just appear to be quite a bit of gas in the Cook Inlet. Is that gas trucked, or do we use rail?
Madam Chair, Gene Terrio, the gas currently is liquefied in the Mat-Su area at the 1 BCF plant, capacity 1 BCF, and it is trucked up to Fairbanks. We have worked with the railroad very cooperatively with the railroad last year as they did the first shipments of LNG in North America, testing out the use of ISOs on rail cars to ship north. Right now, because of the extra handling of the commodity, having to put it in ISO containers, drive it all the way into Anchorage from the Big Lake area, put it on the train up to Fairbanks, then put it on a flatbed, drive it to the LNG plant, all that additional handling makes that uneconomic at the volumes that we're at right now. But we continue to work with the railroad to see if there are ways of dropping off components of that handling, and as the volume goes up, it would lend itself more to the bulk shipment, perhaps of rail transportation. In addition, the trucking that we do, we have purchased one larger capacity trailer. The more capacity you can drag up with each trailer load drops the per unit cost. That trial worked out very well, so we ended up actually purchasing that trial piece of equipment and have ordered two additional larger capacity trailers, again, to drop the existing trucking cost down.
Sure. And if I can follow up, Madam Chair.
Follow up, Senator Meyer.
You know, trucking is good. It provides jobs for truck drivers, obviously, but our Alaska Railroad is kind of hurting for business right now. So if we can make that work, that I think that would be more of a win-win for the whole state, because I think there's, you know, the trucks are going up to the North Slope all the time to take care of the North Slope operations. So they probably are busy enough as it is, but the railroad, I know, could use some more business. So anyway, if you could try to make that work, that would be helpful. And then about the same time that this project was going on, that was about the last year where we still had a capital budget and still had some money. And I know it was also the same time that we that the University of Fairbanks was down here insisting on $150 million for a new coal-powered power plant. And I think we question whether or not that should be gas or oil or instead of coal, because at the time coal wasn't the most popular. But we were told coal was the way to go. But now I'm wondering, if did we make a mistake by not having that be gas, so that, you know, you could better utilize the gas in your project?
Senator Jean Terrio, to the senator's question. We certainly would have loved that bulk demand. The university power plant actually is an interruptible customer of the existing distribution system, and certainly having the bulk to meet all of their energy and electric needs would have been nice. However, just could not compete on a BTU per BTU basis, coal delivered into the interior, especially when you have basically a heat plant that has an electric, you know, component to it. We just could not compete against that.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Hughes.
Yes, and kind of along that same track, and I'm going to preface this first because I had a conversation with you, Mr. Terrio, and I also had a conversation with the ethics administrator because I have a family member who is involved with the company. But I'm wondering if you had checked out the technology, you know, how quickly technology evolves. And there actually are units that can burn coal emission-free that are available. And for two-thirds of the cost of the kickstart, you could put these units in Fairbanks, use coal, improve your air quality, and you wouldn't have to have the $600 million conversion because you could stay on electricity. After I shared that with you, did you pursue that to see if that might be a possibility?
I did, Senator. I think it was on the 27th you and I may have spoken. I think I passed that information on about the company to Mr. Stewart and also Mr. Britton. I did a little web search myself. I couldn't find a lot of information, but I did pass that on.
Follow up,
Senator Hughes.
And as Senator Von Imhoff, there are a lot of state dollars at stake here, and it seems that it is definitely worth pursuing because it is something, my understanding, that could be in place in probably 2 years and at very low cost, would also provide syngas that would be produced, which could then be provided to villages at much cheaper than the cost of diesel. So it does look like something that the state should at least review, and it's with what you're facing with the EPA too. It just seems like something that I hope Fairbanks would consider. And when you are talking this number of dollars and then the $600 million conversion. A lot of people stand to, that's $1 billion essentially, be part of that. And when you're going one direction, I know sometimes it's hard to change gears and look at something else, but I really encourage you to do that because right now it just doesn't look like it's penciling out very well. And so I just wanted to put that on the record. And again, I shared this with the ethics administrator. And when I did, he said, you know, just always state that you talk to me before you mention it. And he said it's too good of a bit of information to withhold. And there's a real possibility for Fairbanks, but I think for about two-thirds of your kickstart money in a couple of years, you could be solving a problem possibly. So thank you, Madam Chair.
And Madam Chairman, technology is always advancing, certainly. And back when the price of energy went up so high, I know that Fedco, which Mr. Stewart used to work at, did look at coal gasification technology in conjunction with some of the military bases, if I remember, because they've got combined heat and power plants on Fort Wainwright and Eielson 2. And it was just determined at that point that technology just didn't exist that would work, as perhaps has been suggested. But understand it's always evolving. The size of units continually change. And so that's one of the things that when we're approached by enterprise, we try and take a look at it, certainly.
Senator Stedman.
Well, thank you, Madam Chairman. I think the train's left the station on this one, and it's probably up to Ada to work out some of these terms going forward. And Fairbanks got caught up in a similar issue as one of my communities going forward with a large project in a high oil price environment, and the price environment changes, and, you know, you're heading down the road. And you don't really like the view, but it's kind of too late. But one thing that concerns me with this project, and it definitely concerns me with the one that we just finished in Sitka Blue Lake, is when the bond guys and finance guys get a little too creative. They start going virtually zero interest for 15 years, as has been referenced earlier, and pushing out the debt to 50 years, and pushing it further and further down the generational path, well beyond our existence before it's paid off. I don't think that's really in the best interest of the general public. And in Sitka's case, there's a dam built 30 years ago, and they continually refinanced it twice and stretched amortization out. Today, we still owe half of the value of that dam. It's 30% of our utility debt, 23% of our payments, as I recall. And if it wasn't for that, you know, carrying that dam that should have been paid for in 30 years for the next 15, the current project wouldn't be such a financial gagger. And I kind of see something similar here where I see this, you know, 15-year deferment. And I just caution my colleagues that we need to take a look at these things with a jaundiced eye and have a conversation with our, you know, the state finance people that sometimes putting these projects together might not necessarily be in the best interest in the long run. I want to see this project work and get natural gas to Fairbanks. I see the military advantage that the country has and the state has and the economic activity that's going to produce in Fairbanks and the particulate matter of getting away from wood. So I don't fault the community for going forward and trying to do everything they can to make this work, but just use Sitka as an example. Just be careful.
And Madam Chairman, I know that Ms. Jean Terrio, especially when you have something like a hydro dam in particular that is multi-generational, there always is this give and take between how long do you make those payments, because it is multi-generational, folks, you know, 50 years from now are going to be getting the benefit of that infrastructure. So what portion of that cost should they bear? Because they get the benefit. So there's always this give and take. Rest assured, as we have negotiated both the MOU and the documents underneath the MOU, the ADA board is insistent that they see a combined utility enterprise that is strong enough to be able to go to the bond market And ADA will help facilitate that, but it will really be the project going to the bond market. They're going to have a strong enough enterprise to convince the bond market that they should have access to the bond funds. And it will be that market that then determines the risk and interest rate that gets
Senator Stedman.
Just one more word of caution. A lot of times in the bond covenants that they like to put the general credit of the community on the hook and the taxing authority that the community has. So I don't disagree with what you said at all, but there's always this bond covenant hooks where this, you know, falls. If it doesn't work as planned, maybe the penetration ratio is not there or pricing environments change or what have you, they default right back to the outside of the utilities, right to the taxpayer, the property owner.
The other thing I would remind members, they might have remembered this story, but, you know, before ADA acquired Pentex, there was a private entity that was attempting to purchase the Titan LNG assets. So the other thing, we had a presentation last week by Marianne Ka. She's the corporate economist for ConocoPhillips, and you may have seen it, Mr. Terrio, but she's projecting oil prices not much above $80 a barrel for a very long time. Mm-hmm. So I don't know what that it would equate to in terms of gas price, but and oil price, you know, diesel for heating.
Certainly, and certainly there is that correlation between the two. As oil has gone up and down, the price of fuel oil sometimes ratchets down. It seems like it ratchets back up more quickly than going down. And in today's at today's oil price, as I indicated about a month or month and a half ago, the delivered price to residential consumers was about $2.40. So if it goes up to 80, I'm not sure that it's linear, but you would expect that delta would become bigger.
All right. We have about, I'm going to say, 15, 20 minutes left, so you can see committee members have jumped ahead.
I will rock and roll through it, miss. Respectfully through the chair, I just paid my last oil bill. It was more like $2.50. So I may have to call Gene's distributor. Okay. So just so everyone knows, the MOU, what this slide is the it kind of shows you the scope of the project per the MOU. And that is completing the infill within FNG system and then building out phases 1, 2, and 3. And it'll be the strength of the project and the strength of the utility thereafter to you know, come up with the money for the additional phases. This is just a map of the air quality area within Fairbanks, just so you can kind of see what that looks like. The main hotspot being there in your right-hand side, which is North Pole, Alaska. And what you notice if you did an overlay is that we actually covered with our Phase 1 development in 2015 the southern half of that hotspot. We got half the hotspot. And so this will allow us to, if allowed to proceed, this will allow us to cover the entire hotspot and begin to move around through, again, the worst quality area, air quality area. So by the numbers, again, as Mr. Terrio said, again, this is a lot of this is built on the work of an outfit that was called Cardinal Entrix. Again, they did between ADA, IGU, and Cardinal Entrix some rather robust research regarding conversions because all of this hinges on the use of gas by customers. So the numbers are based on you'll see the customer count. We go from within about 1,000 customers, it says here 1,140, up to a total of almost 9,000. The demand profile goes from what is, in fact, under a BCF of gas. I want to say that FNG sales are about 100 million cubic feet a year, up to a total of more like 5.3 BCF. We increase the deliverability up to 5.4 BCF. That's relative to the plant kind of sticker production rate of LNG of about 7.5 million at full build out. With a with a customer estimated customer cost of gas at the meter of $15.50. Let's see, and then with revenues associated. Okay, and there at the bottom you get to see, we did do get an order of magnitude estimate from Sierra Research, which is the borough and DEC's go-to enterprise for air quality, of about a 10% improvement of air quality within core Fairbanks, but an over 25% improvement of air quality within the most impacted zone out there in North Pole. Okay, so again, the scope of the project, Titans 1, 2, and 3, again, bringing up, getting to that 7.5 billion cubic feet of capacity, large-scale LNG storage. I think sometimes people forget that when it comes to LNG, we do need storage to help with the deliverability. You have to have a place where you can hold on to it so that you can meter out those deliveries to customers. You also need it so that you can take on firm customers. Because, again, once people convert over their furnaces, they need that gas to show up without fail. So 5.2 million gallons worth of storage in the Fairbanks area, another 150,000 gallons in the IGU development zone out in North Pole. Okay, so the key financial terms, again, it's about $330 million are kind of spoken to regarding the MOU. Gives the structure of the SETS loan, also speaks to the amount of bonding that would be necessary to actually construct all of these major components. Again, it also talks about the purchase of Pentex by IGU, thereby paying ADA back to its revolving fund with interest. And then the process and timing of system integration, all being contingent, of course, upon the economic – we need an economically sufficient gas supply contract to support this, as well as due diligence and RCA approval of transfer of sale or transfer of ownership. Okay, so you can see the funds available. This is actually from the MOU. One of the appendices, so the sources of funds, of course, is the balance of the grant funds remaining of about $42 million, $125 million worth of SETS funds, and a little over $140 million worth of bonding. And again, speaking of the private sector, again, these are private sector bonds. So the market is helping to finance this. And then some straight commercial debt for the trucks and trailers, and hopefully reimbursement of the storage tax credit that helps balance these things out, for a total of about $334 million.
And Madam Chairman, just to clarify a question that Senator Hughes had, the 600,000 then is not additive to that. The 330 is basically half of what was estimated to be the total build out, which was 600,000 or 600 million. Excuse me.
Okay, but important. Oh, Madam Chair. Oh, okay. You had your finger up. I thought you.
No, sorry.
Okay, sorry, ma'am. Yes. Yeah, so as to the use of funds, and so this gets to this is where you get to see exactly what we're getting for the money. So the Titan II facility is estimated at about $46 million. Titan III and subsequent tranches of natural gas LNG capacity about $25 million a pop, for a total of about $71 million under the MOU. Transportation at $4.75 million. Regarding LNG storage, particularly for the uninitiated, it doesn't quite compute. Generally with oil, oil storage is about a buck a gallon. You need 100,000 gallons worth of oil storage, it's about $100,000. LNG storage is more like a factor of 1 to 8, so it's grossly expensive, but it is necessary. Again, when you're in a disconnected community where your fuel source is going to be coming by road to have adequate storage, otherwise you can't take on firm customers, and it's part of the pickle why FNG couldn't expand for as many years as it couldn't, because it simply did not have the adequate storage and could not get authorization from their private holders to make the investment in LNG storage. This takes care of that. To the tune of about $53 million. Regarding the purchase of Pentex, again, we do repay the revolving fund for the original purchase price plus interest, so that's about $58 million. And then you see the incidental costs regarding the build-out phases, about $87 million, almost $90 million for the build-outs out in North Pole, the infill and FNG service area in Fairbanks, as well as those other incidentals. And there at the very bottom, you'll see the customer conversion program that, again, is built into the programmatic funding for that total of that $333 million. Wasn't going to even try to hide from it, so, yeah, just made a big old slide for it. These are the terms regarding the SETS loan to help make this all work. It's about, again, it has a 15-year deferral on the front end with no principal payments, no interest accruing, no interest payments, 0.25 interest rate when it does begin making repayment for a 35-year payback term thereafter. But on the upside, again, remember this heretofore, we have made some really substantial investments here in the state of Alaska on a non-payback at all basis, and that was with grants. And so under this, we did have a revolving loan concept, and we were hoping that we could make these funds reavailable in the future. And if we started to move towards a revolving fund concept, funds would be reavailable for other communities and other projects around the state. Okay, and so this is the impact. I will tell you that there is a very robust model that underpins everything that you've been seeing. And if it wasn't for that, the results of that modeling, the ADA board would have never authorized the letting of funds for this project. But that model did indicate that under these terms, you could make this substantial investment. You could meet your target. We could meet our target regarding the $15, thereby having the chance of accruing that customer base based on the Cardno-Entrix original study and sensitivity analysis. And we could hold that rate hopefully long enough to really reach those that critical mass of customer base that allows this utility and this enterprise to be self-sustaining. Okay. And so next steps. In the short term, we are drafting right now those detailed purchase and sale and financing documents that are envisioned by the MOU. In fact, I had a four-hour teleconference just in the middle of the day that actually came hard on the heels of a three-hour teleconference yesterday as we're moving through those documents. They have been provided by ADA. Thank you, guys. Let's see. Due diligence is progressing, as well as utility integration planning. Much of my team and their efforts are actually involved in that. Again, we are purchasing. We're making a $60 million investment, buying an existing utility, so we can unite these utilities under community control, and so that's ongoing. Let's see. We are working diligently to try to achieve a gas supply contract that can actually underpin what we've designed, and it's been going on for months, and we're working diligently at it.
Senator Stedman.
Thank you, my friend. I was just thinking of the people at home trying to get a feel for what we're talking about. I think that $15 per MMBTU is about somewhere around 5 cents a kilowatt or $2 oil.
Yes, sir.
So those at home that are used to paying their electrical bill and looking at it every month, it's a nickel a kilowatt. That's probably one reason why the economics are so challenging. Mm-hmm. But anyway, I just wanted to make that comment, Madam Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Stedman. I'll let you proceed.
Thank you, ma'am. And respectfully to the chair, Senator Stedman, it's also one of the reasons why when we as a group, and when I was at FEDC, we did look at a proposal regarding transmission of electricity over an intertie from the North Slope as a potential solution. But however, again, we're paying about 23 cents a kilowatt hour in Fairbanks right now for electricity. You'd have to have 5 cent per kilowatt hour power to meet that $2 a gallon fuel oil goal. And so it's even if we got free power today, free electricity in Fairbanks, the administrative costs at GBA mean that it would still be more in like the 13 cents per kilowatt hour frame. We'd actually be doubling people's cost of energy to try to heat their homes rather than having it. But let's see. The immediate capital program, again, move forward expeditiously regarding the FEED, the front-end engineering and design, move forward on LNG storage. We actually would hope to have that stuff under construction. We were hoping to have it under construction actually this winter, so we'd definitely like to begin that construction by this fall. Let's see, ADA put them in a position to be able to pass their HB 105 resolution. I believe we have a slide on that. Get RC approval of transfer of ownership, execution of MOU-related documents, and integration of the utilities. Regarding HB 105, the legislature passed when they reauthorized SB 23, essentially, in HB 105. They did add some additional reporting requirements for ADA, and they also implemented essentially a planning requirement so that we didn't get into the same kind of position we had gotten in the North Slope, where a sizable amount of project funds had been expended on something that actually will not directly positively impact the consumer in Fairbanks. And what that is called an HB 105 resolution, where ADA board will certify by resolution the source of natural gas and estimated project cost, as well as the pre-distribution cost of that gas to Fairbanks, essentially the city gate price. Most of what is required for ADA to be able to pass that resolution actually is built in and is envisioned by the MOU. So a lot of that work has been done.
And okay. Madam Chairman, just also the HB 105 requirements, the quarterly report that we put out, and today is the end of the quarter, so that will be delivered to the legislature next week, is built around that structure, you know, touching on all of those components that the ADA board has to see before they can certify an HB 105, what we call an HB 105 plan.
Okay. And in the longer term, of course, again, the conversion program, again, we're working through that. When I mentioned the on-bill repayment program, again, that is just one of many options that have been assessed. There's actually a group up in Fairbanks we've been working with to run down a number of different ways that we might be able to assist homeowners and businesses with a conversion process. Again, it can range from anywhere between $2,000, as Gene was saying, with a simple boiler or some blower replacement, up to the tens of thousands of dollars. And again, we do recognize that having had upwards of $300 million a year sucked out of our economy for a decade with the cost of oil, that a lot of people are in a bit of a challenged position, as we want to be able to help out as much as we can. Again, get the storage tanks constructed, LNG plant construction, finalization of transportation plans, and distribution build-out. And finally,
yes, pause for questions. Senator Von Imhoff.
So under longer-term steps, the next steps, do you have a time frame, months, years, anything attached to any of these at all?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. So, like, for the storage tanks constructed, when might those start, and how long will they take?
Yes, ma'am. Respectfully to the chair, construction of the LNG storage tanks takes about 2 years. It needs to begin in the fall because of the way we're going to construct it. Again, you don't want to harm the permafrost, so it's going to happen in winter. It takes about 2 years, but we also recognize that the time limit on the storage reimbursement, the storage would have to be up and in operation by 2020, and so we're going to meet that timeline. Regarding the LNG facility, it takes about 18 months to 2 years. I can tell you that at the IGU, we're actually the great holders of the grant schedule, and it's fairly robust. And so built into the MOU, though, you will see that there is a project schedule. Not only do you see a project schedule built in, but you also get to see the timing of when the funds are allocated or spent to do these different things. It's a fairly detailed document. Yes, ma'am. And finally, I just want to put in a few slides, the quote-unquote make them real slides. So if you look there, you actually see our design layout for the for the natural gas distribution system, at least for the IGU. And those are the actual pipes. Here's phase one. This is what we put in the ground in 2015. Those lines that you see within the colored area are, in fact, in the ground right now. That's where the pipes are. For phase two, moving up to the north side again of that hotspot. These are planned, obviously, but that's that development zone around Badger Road in North Pole. And then finally, phases 4, 5, and 6 along the arc, those are going to take a bit longer. What is subsumed, however, by, again, the MOU is essentially a plan to be able to kind of move this forward and have those first three phases as well as F&G's infill completed by the 2022 timeframe. Subject to conversion. I do want to stress that we do fully intend. F&G has been a very good operator. They're a very good outfit. Again, formerly private sector. They haven't stopped operating as if they're private sector just because they've gone into public ownership. So we would expect to use their resources and their horsepower, their physical and mental resources, and act prudently as a utility. What that means is if demand is slower than what is estimated by Cardno, you can expect that we would probably delay some of this construction rather than simply charge ahead and get ourselves into a hole. That kind of maybe a potentially imprudent allocation or use of your state funds, that we would delay. We would make our investments for a return as opposed to aspirational thinking. Okay. And so finally, just again, the summation slide. The purpose and goals of the IEP: bring reduced costs, bring affordable energy to as many people as possible, as quickly as possible, help stabilize our own local economy and improve air quality, but also hopefully we hoped we would be able to provide a model of development for other similarly situated communities around the state, of which there are hundreds.
Very good. Questions from committee members? All right. Thank you very much for the update. We will look forward to the report that will be coming out, the quarterly update, and appreciate that. Very good. Thanks for coming.
Thank you very much, ma'am.
All right. We will transition now to hearing Senate Bill 92, public testimony. So Senate Bill 92 had to do with the derelict vessels that are polluting our waterways. And we didn't have time to get to public testimony at that time, so we're going to do that today, as promised. So we've got folks online. So for those of you online, I'm going to ask that public testimony be limited to 2 minutes. If you would announce your name and any affiliation and then give us your public testimony. So I'm going to start at the Homer LIO. There are a couple folks there. Brian Hawkins is first. Mr. Hawkins, can you hear us?
Yeah, good afternoon. For the record, my name is Brian Hawkins. I'm the harbor master for Homer, Alaska, and vice president for the Alaska Association of Harbor Masters and Port Administrators, AAHPA. I served on the ad hoc derelict vessel task force as a representative for AHPA, and I'm speaking today in support of Senate Bill 92 on derelict vessels. Alaska is a maritime state. Most of our population lives next to the ocean, and our connection to it is vital to our ability to exist, either by directly pulling our livelihoods from the sea or simply because of the fact that most of our goods we purchase and use every day are transported across the water. Alaska is in the business of boats. We have a thinking error when it comes to vessels, any boat, large or small, and that is that we behave as if they will last forever. That is evidenced by the fact that we currently have no plan for when they don't. Alaska's must work together to develop a cradle-to-grave management plan for our vessels. This plan must work to protect the individual's rights of ownership, promote and encourage fleet renewal, while at the same time protect the state, municipalities, and private landowners from becoming the dump site for vessels that have no commercial value left in them. I realize that this is a huge task and that we're starting late, but I don't believe it's an impossible one, and SB 92 is a big step forward in that effort. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Hawkins, for your testimony. Let's see, next there in Homer also is Rachel Lord. Rachel, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. And I just wanted to, I spoke with you at the last hearing, and I just wanted to use my time. I'm with the Alaska Association of Harbor Masters and Port Administrators. I did facilitate the ad hoc Abinan Derelict Vessel Task Force, and I want to be clear that any of my comments are mine alone and not to represent in any way any of the members or agencies that sat at the table for the task force. I just wanted to, again, express my support for SB 92 and really for this entire effort. It's a huge step forward. A couple of days ago, the Federal Government Accountability Office came out with a report that they've been working on since 2015 that was requested by Alaska's entire congressional delegation, as well as many senators and congressmen from around the country, asking the federal government to look at the issue of derelict vessels and where we are. And it really, it paints a picture that we have a long ways to go. Alaska is one state that has derelict vessel laws, but they are very outdated, and they need a lot of work. And I know that there is a lot in this bill. There are a lot of pieces. From my perspective, with the task force, the effort was to look at the full suite of problems that folks are experiencing and dealing with derelict vessels on state waters, and to look at what are some solutions, what are solutions that people are using around the country, and what could work here. And so I encourage you to please look at this as a holistic effort, that there may be pieces that need work. I have been talking more to insurance companies and commercial fishing folks on the insurance end of things, and still feel like insurance is a really important tool in the toolbox, and that P&I insurance, which would be what would be covered under SB 92 with the wreck removal, would be the intent is not to be really an added burden on our commercial fishing fleets or active commercial vessels, but to be something that is a protection when vessels are transferred and when folks are considering on-water endeavors. At any rate, I want to say that insurance is just one piece of a very large puzzle. So thank you very much for your work on this.
Thank you very much, Rachel. Next, I'm going to move to the Bethel LIO. Greg Rokzinka is there. Greg, welcome. Identify yourself for the record and give us your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. For the record, my name is Greg Rokzinka, and I'm here today speaking for the Kuskokwim Salmon Management Working Group. It's a group of stakeholders that's been in place working with the state of Alaska on fisheries issues since back in 1988, dealing with commercial subsistence. We have a full range of membership, but I'm here today specifically to express our wholehearted support on Senate Bill 92. I certainly appreciate it being put forward. Some of us participated in the task force process. We've been pushing these kind of issues for many years. And even in just past 2 or 3 years, we've continued to see vessels sink or construction outfits and drop equipment off the side of their barges when it goes down. Those vessels are still sitting there to this day. They pose a significant navigation hazard. People that running our outboards or hit them, not realizing they're underneath, so take out their lower unit. We had people injured on one that's in a slough just a little ways up. It was in Bethel, people hitting them by snow machines at night. It's a real major concern, and it is throughout the whole river. The Kuskokwim drainage, of course, as you know, is the second largest river in the state from the base of Mount McKinley out to the Bering Sea by Nunavak Island. And throughout the drainages, people that have similar problems, and without going into a whole lot further, there's just a strongly urge your support and passage, and certainly glad that we've got something moving here to put some teeth in, some enforcement, and help to address this problem. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Greg. Also there in the Bethel LIO is Alyssa Rogers. Alyssa, we got the photos from you today along with your with some written testimony, and those are posted on BASIS just for your information. But if you would identify yourself for the record and give us your testimony.
Good afternoon, Madam Chairman, Chair Senator Giesel, and Senate Resource Committee. I am Alyssa Nadine Rogers, representing our Southern Mute Native Council. But Southern Mute Native Council is a federally recognized governing body for the Native Village of Bethel, Alaska. But Southern Mute Native Council strongly supports Senate Bill 92, and that holds people accountable for abandoning barges on public waters and streamlines the state's ability to prevent and manage derelict vessels. In direct support of SB 92, will address the known 40-plus abandoned and derelict vessels of steamboat slough and 20 more within the Bethel Native Corporation land. These vessels have been on economic abandoned derelict and derelict vessels mooring on the tribal tidal grounds and banks. They are hazardous. Over the past decade, ONC and other organizations in Bethel have been asking for assistance to remove these vessels. There are no agencies that have the ability to help. For instance, Shanks Arch just sunk a few years back, sunk in the middle of Steamboat Slough, as you've seen in those pictures. It has become an increasingly dangerous and hazardous to motorized vehicles, people, subsistence harvesters, and the environment. SB 92 will provide a program with proactive strategies to address such occurrences as Bethel's derelict vessels. Without this action, the town towns like Bethel will continue to suffer the dangerous burden of derelict vessels and abandoned vessels. They will continue to be a hazardous to traffic human life in our ecosystem. We strongly urge and recommend your support of this important legislation. Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you very much for your testimony, Alyssa. So next we're going to Stephen Russell. This is in the Kenai LIO. Stephen, if you'd identify yourself for your record and give us your 2 minutes of testimony.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Stephen Russell. I'm a former state on scene coordinator with the Department of Environmental Conservation. Currently, I'm working in the environmental field outside of state government. Thank you for the opportunity today to speak on behalf of Senate Bill 92. Much attention of this legislation is focused on the registration and titling of vessels that operate in state waters. In efforts to address a currently abandoned vessel, state and federal managers can spend hundreds of man hours trying to identify ADV vessel ownership, mostly to no avail. A state registration and titling system will be a significant resource to reduce future problems of this sort. While registration and titling aspect of the legislation are very important, we must not lose sight of the intent of the proposed legislation, and that is the hundreds of ADVs currently around the state. These vessels pose a real threat to public health and safety, are damaging our habitat, interfering with commercial fisheries and subsistence lifestyles, and can impede or complicate economic opportunities in our remote community. In Section 24 of your package, it deals with ADV programs to increase prevention, assist communities to develop proper disposal options, educate vessel owner operators, and develop other programs that incentivize the removal of the current fleet of abandoned vessels on state tidelands. This effort, of course, should receive the support of every port and harbor administration, boatyards, vessel owners, and communities that are affected by these vessels, and will provide a long-term plan essential to sound maritime operations. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Stephen. Next, I'm going to go to the off-net. John Erickson is in Yakutat calling in, the city manager. John, can you hear us?
Yes, I can. Thank you very much for having me this morning and letting me testify, or this evening, I guess it is. I'm John Erickson. I'm the city and borough manager of Yakutat, and I wanted to call in support of SB 92. We have a number of derelict vessels, and because we're so isolated, trying to clean them up on state land is almost impossible, and trying to get barges up here to haul them away. So anything we could do to try and identify owners and help us out certainly make a big difference for us. And, we just have a number of boats that really are polluting and damaging the environment up here. So I want to just say that and thank you for listening to my testimony.
Thank you very much, John. I see that Betty Svensson is here in the room to testify. Betty, if you'd come forward.
Hello.
Welcome.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Betty Svensson. I'm the Deputy Director of the Alaska Municipal League. Actually, Kathy planned on being here to testify, but she's stuck in another hearing. So I would just like to go on record that AML is in support of Senate Bill 92, and that Kathy will be submitting a letter of support along with a copy of our resolution number 2017-13, supporting changes to the Alaska statutes to improve the management and prevention of derelict vessels. So,
very good. All right. Well, thank you.
Okay, thank you.
All right. That looks like everybody online that wished to testify. Is there anyone in the room that wishes to testify on Senate Bill 92? Seeing no one, I'll close public testimony. The bill sponsor has joined us, Senator Machicki. Senator Machicki, would you like to make any comments on today's testimony or closing remarks related to today?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Peter Machicki, District O. Proud to cover this bill. There's obviously widespread exposure and potential in the state. There has been widespread damage. I think this bill is helpful. It's well considered. I very much appreciate the work of the Harbor Masters and Rachel's leadership with that group. Don't plan to pass it out this year. I am fine with that. We have some work to do. We're going to get some folks together and make sure we walk them through the various pieces and create the very best piece of legislation we can. It's in a great place for spending the summer talking about what kind of improvements might be necessary and how to make it the most functional. So very much appreciate your time and all those that testified. I'm here for questions if you have any.
Very good. Any questions for Senator Machicki? All right. Seeing none, we will set the bill aside. Look forward to working on it over the summer. I'm sure committee members would be happy to join you in that as well. So thank you, Senator Machicki. So that concludes our meeting agenda for today. Our next meeting is on Monday, April 3rd. The committee will again take a public testimony on Senate Bill 88, and we'll hear Senate Bill 65 for the first time. So the meeting is adjourned. The time is 4:47 p.m.